I promised yesterday to give you some analogies of the for the term sati in the Buddhist text, in the early Buddhist tradition. It is easy to ascertain that what the Buddha called mindfulness is very at the heart of meditative development, both for insight and for stillness, both for cultivation of wisdom and the development of contentment and the capacities of empathy in their four forms of metta, loving kindness, karuna, compassion, mudita, joy or sympathetic joy, and upekkha, equanimity. So we have sati very much at the heart of development of stillness, development of insight, development of a broader applicable wisdom, development of ethics, development of the heart's resonances. So you couldn't really be more central. But instead of looking at definitions of the term and at looking at the list in which the term occurs, I'd like to share some of the lesser-known analogies. Sometimes it's easier to understand something that comes from a long distance and from another culture via images rather than via definitions, because definitions are only as good as we can contextualize terms. And to contextualize a term that was used 2,500 years ago is hard work. Yeah? Imagine anything that is 2,500 years old. Doesn't just make for bedtime reading, isn't it? You know, it's one thing. People always tell me, I'd like to study suttas, but they're so boring. They're kind of repetitive, and it's difficult, and I don't know what it means, and it's full of Pali terms. And yes, this is true. But, you know, if you're going to read Jack Kornfield, who is a contemporary author, psychologically trained and well capable of writing, then this is one thing, yeah? We appreciate him for his clarity and so forth. And a few other authors, contemporary authors. But we can't compare a text that is 2,500 years old with a contemporary rewriter's explanations. You know, this just isn't... It's unfair. You wouldn't want to think of Platonian dialogues as bedtime reading. Yeah? You'd expect to do hard work to get to understand what he speaks about when he speaks about quality or about freedom or about things like that. Yeah. We all know that. This is hard work to start a discourse with something that is 2,500 years old, yeah? Written in another language and in another culture. So the suttas are actually quite understandable compared to some of the competitors from those days. They're a lot more comprehensible than, say, Germanic runes, who are not even half as old, you know. Or some of the Greek fun. Aristophanes jokes. People don't even understand Swift anymore. Gulliver's Travels is a children's book now. You know, with a snarky aside on his political situation 400 years ago, is basically now relegated to being a children's book because nobody gets the context. Or if you want to get the context, you have to be prepared to put in some work contextualizing. Anyway, so images sometimes travel easier. So what images do we get in the suttas for the quality we call mindfulness, yeah, or it is called sati? The famous sati, the sati of the Anapanasati Sutta, mindfulness and breathing, the famous sati of the Satipatthana Sutta, the sutta on bringing about mindfulness, the sutta on Kayagata Sati, on awareness of the body. So, what images do we find for this elusive quality called awareness, mindfulness, vigilance, presence of mind? One image is quite dark. It speaks of a man balancing a bowl brimful of with oil on his head. And he's walking through a crowd. The crowd is assembled to see the belle of the day dancing and singing. And so our man has to do this difficult thing, carrying a bowl full of oil on his head, and another guy standing or walking behind him with a drawn sword, threatening to chop off his head at the first drop spilled. Now imagine that. You walk through a crowd, something on your head that you could, with the slightest ill-considered move, bring to overflow, and somebody behind your back with a sword pointed and drawn, threatening to lop off your head at the first moment of bodily unawareness. The Buddha asks, this, monks, I tell you, is an image for mindfulness of the body. Would such a man be careless in his movements? Would such a man be lacking one moment of awareness of what he precisely feels? Yeah. So this is an image for body awareness. Now, how would you feel? Sitting there, somebody with a drawn sword in your back for 45 minutes. Now that gives you a sense of alacrity, isn't it? Other images speak of a man climbing onto the bench of a chariot, overlooking the road, his animals, the cart, and having a sort of panoramic overview of things because he's slightly elevated. That image of slight elevation and the panoramic overview occurs several times. Another time it's a man climbing onto a tower or onto the upper story of an Indian house, which is often where much life happens during the day. And he overlooks and he sees the lay of the land. So we have sati in the first image, kind of a unremitting vigilance of bodily moves, bodily sensations, bodily states. Second image, the third, speak of a sort of panoramic overview, have a slightly scanning, sweeping quality to it. Yeah. Then we have a range of images, two images where we have sati that is compared with a gatekeeper. In one situation, the gatekeeper just scrutinizes everybody who wants to go into the city, and some people he lets in and some people he doesn't let in. He knows the ones who belong to the city and he lets them in, and then he doesn't know the other ones and he looks at them, and they have to have good reason to be let in. For some, he turns down. And the sati in this role as a scrutinizing gatekeeper. The commentary suggests that, like the gatekeeper keeps the people who do not have any business in town, keeps them out. So in such a way, the heart, or sati, takes care that the heart is only preoccupied with things that are wholesome, that do not take the heart astray. Second image of a sati is again the gatekeeper, but this time in a completely different function. This time the function is, sati is the gatekeeper awaits two messengers who have important, truthful messages to bring. They come from afar. By the way, they're called samatha and vipassana. That's it. These are the names. And the gatekeeper has a job to take them in the most direct way to the governor of the city. So he doesn't want his messengers getting lost in the maze of alleys. He doesn't want to get lost and stuck somewhere in the market towns, in the market stalls. So the job of the gatekeeper is to wait till they come and accompany them on the most direct and most efficient way so that they can deliver their important messages. Yeah. So sati clearly in the role of efficiency. Then we have an interesting image of sati likened to the task of a surgeon, a wound surgeon who has an injured man. Man has an arrowhead in his flesh, shaft is broken off, and the arrowhead has disappeared completely into the body of the man. So what we have is a wound and an arrowhead of unknown size and unknown shape and unknown depth. And our surgeon opens that wound very, very gently and inserts a probe. And with that probe, he investigates what he cannot see with bare eyes. He investigates the depth, the size, and the shape of that arrowhead. And sati is likened to that probe. It goes where we do not see with bare eyes. It goes even where it hurts. It is soft enough to be inserted and not do any damage, and it is hard enough to give us a tactile feedback of what it actually finds. So sati very clearly in a probing, investigating sort of role. This is a very powerful and, I think, interesting image which speaks of the kind of facet of wisdom which is already in seed quality in as a facet of sati. Another image speaks of sati with the analogy of a cowherd boy who has to look after cows. We have two takes. Take one shows our boy struggling with his cows in the rainy season, which means rainy season means the fruit of the fields are high up. The cows want to run away from the meadow and they want to go and eat the fruit of the field. So, trampled there by the fruit and get into the grains. And our cowherd boy obviously tries to stop that from happening by all means. And the cows, there's a considerable pull of them to kind of go in these fields and to do what they're not supposed to do. So our boy screams at the cows. He has a stick. He shakes his fist. He shakes his stick. He jumps up and down. He runs after them. He puts his body in between the cows and the field. So he has a hard job. Yeah? The Buddha calls this practice rakati, protection, to protect. And then take two, you have the very same cows and the very same boys, but this time it's after the rainy season. It's the Hemantotu, it's the cold season, and the fields are harvested. The cows are no longer interested in running around, they just stay there on their meadow. There is no big pull for them to go anywhere else, they just graze happily. And our boy is in the shadow of a bush or a tree and kind of occasionally raises his head and looks, oh, my cows are still there. Everything is all right. This practice the Buddha calls to establish sati, as opposed to protection. So when the cows, when the pull of the cows is not there, it's you don't need to jump up and down and beat them and scream at them. It's perfectly all right to just occasionally look that they're still there, and if they're still there, that's all the effort you need to take. Again, sati, suggestive of relaxed, spacious, open awareness. It's another facet of sati. Again, in contrast to this, we have an image of sati that describes a firm post, deeply rooted, and on this firm post there are six chains, and on each chain is a wild animal. And each wild animal wants to get away into his domain. The crocodile wants to go in the water, the bird wants to fly away. And they're quite wild and restless, and they're pulling at their chains. But the post does not budge. And the wild animals get slightly tired and start making less effort. They start to kind of tire and trot. And after a while they kind of sit or even lie down and become tame. And sati is likened to that very post. And the wild animals are our senses. And these senses are continually seeking for stimulation. And in some ways, sometimes we like the stimulation, then we call it gratification, and sometimes we don't like the stimulation, then we call it agitation or irritation or so. But basically, these animals are pulling constantly in us. Yeah? They constantly want something. Particularly, they want to go to where they feel they belong. So sati is that which helps us to let these animals come to rest and holds them back, stabilizes them. This is the aspect of sati that has most to do with samadhi, with stillness. Yeah. By emphasizing this facet of sati, the stabilizing, solidifying, restraining aspect, this is the aspect which most strongly leads into the development of citta samadhi, the mind at peace. Then we have some other interesting images. One of them speaks of a plowman. A plowman has a yoke of oxen in front of him and has his job of tilling the soil. And sati is likened with the stick the plowman uses to keep his oxen straight and with the plow. Yeah? Now imagine such a plow. Now, this wasn't a very sophisticated type of plow, in fact. If you go to Bihar in India, you probably still see some of these plows. They basically consist of a piece of wood going into the earth, which may be reinforced in the part in which it goes into the ground. Then they have a sort of small platform where you can put, the tiller can put its weight on, so to press the plow deep enough into the earth, because if it doesn't go deep, it just scratches the surface. If it does go too deep, it gets stuck. Yeah. And then you have a main holm, and then finally two handles by which you can hold that plow. So our plowman holds this with one hand, and he keeps his oxen on track, because you want to have a straight furrow, isn't it? So we have sati here, a kind of a clarity of direction, I think we could translate that as, and say that the amount of weight you give to your plow, we could liken to appropriateness of effort, yeah, or appropriateness of application. So the double job of sati is kind of keeping the direction clear and also to gauging the right amount of effort it takes to till the soil so that it breaks nicely, and that, so we are told by the commentary, that what was hidden, namely the three characteristics of impermanence, conditionality and emptiness or impersonality, become obvious. Yeah? So what was hidden underneath the soil is becoming obvious. So I think that's a very interesting image, because it speaks of a double function of sati, yeah? Clarity of direction and appropriateness of effort. Let me think. There's another image. This is in the Milindapanna and in the commentaries. Sati is described as being precisely not like a gourd that you throw into the river. You know, the gourd is carried away by the drift in the river, by the current, and sati is not being carried away by the flow of conceptual thought. Sati enters the object it has chosen to investigate. Sati provides stability. Sati goes deep. It does not drift away. Does not follow the current of discursive phenomena and drift off. Let me think. That is quite already a few images, isn't it? And you realize how difficult it is to make a sort of three-line definition of sati. Sati is choiceless awareness. No, not really. You know. Sati is non-judgmental. No, not really. The gatekeeper says, these are good people, they get in. These are bad people, they don't get in. You know. Sati is kind of effortless. No, not really. Sati is a firm pillar going down into the earth, holding back wild animals. You know. Sati is many things, you see. It's slightly refractory to definitions we quite easily would like to cook up. If you want to cook up appropriate definitions, they're kind of going more like paragraph length rather than, you know, soundbite terseness of three lines and a couple of catchy adjectives. So if you look at the imagery in the suttas, speaking of what this quality, this elusive quality of mind is like, I think they're quite telling, isn't it? If we wanted to say, what that is in psychological language. You would find things like openness, spaciousness, circumspection, vigilance, quite dedicated application, efficiency, investigation, probing, researching, scrutinizing, holding, entering into, we end up with quite a lot of things Sati actually does. Quite a fluid quality also. So consider, when you think mindful, what does that mean? You've heard yourself speaking yesterday. None of you said the same thing about mindfulness. Now that says something. We obviously have an inkling of what this is about, isn't it? We sense coherency in our experience. We sense that we have perspective. We sense that, yes, there is a point for Sati to be right in there, specific, precise, topical, and follow something very defined in its course of change and witness any changing phenomena while it does that. Yeah, there is one. Yeah, there is something to be said for Sati doing that. But then there is also the kind of open, wide, spacious, receiving, big Sati, which doesn't do the kind of attention, vigilant, scrutinizing bit. It just kind of receives, isn't it? Now, Buddhist traditions have been making use of this. You know, if you look at, say, Burmese Satipatthana practice, which goes into hunting Rupa Kalapas right down for every moment of change, this is a slightly different meditational approach than if you go for a sort of Tibetan Dzogchen approach, where you kind of rest in primordial suchness and let things take place. Now, these are quite differing aspects. Now, all of these aspects you can somehow trace back right down to the notion of Sati, which is at the heart of all of these meditative approaches. The stillness approach, you know, the object-focused samadhi approach, the object-focused vipassana approach, the spacious awareness, timeless awareness approach, all this you can trace back as going right down to the facets of Sati. Within Sati, you have, a prisma of different functions of mind that are all kind of converging in this one quality. And you get a feeling why this is so important for the Buddha. And why this is so central to some of its teaching. And while there is such an emphasis in the developmental culture of Sati. So how could that look in our daily experience? Let me give you a few examples that are totally non-scriptural. We could make differing stages. There is many valid models of stratifying meditative experience, but one simple model would be, if you have no Sati really, then your attention simply gets pulled out to whatever is screaming loudest. It's just straightforward involuntary attention, as I spoke of yesterday. We know that this is not a Buddhist invention. Aristotle wrote about this and said, sometimes you lose things right in front of your nose, things you look at when a sudden sound happens or when your attention gets pulled away. Yeah. Although the thing is right in front of your nose in the full field of your vision, you lose contact with that thing because your attention gets pulled away by a loud sound out on the road, for example. Huh? Aristotle, it's quite a while ago. Obviously, he figured something about involuntary attention. You have chosen to look at something, and something dramatic or loud or unexpected happens, and your voluntary attention is completely overruled by the impulse to follow as involuntary attention a sudden sensory stimulus. We know that. We all know that from practical experience. That's why kids get screamed at by parents, you know, because it's very difficult to sustain whatever you're doing if somebody turns up the volume. Yeah. This is very, very difficult. I don't understand this is an encouragement, but as a practical habit, this is why people get screamed at, because they will then no longer be able to maintain their self-chosen focus of attention, because the volume by which you scream at them brings into play their involuntary attention, whereby you get what you want, namely their attention, yeah, which they have so far refused to give you. This works, doesn't it? So the first stage is basically being operating completely on involuntary attention, which means my attention goes to wherever the biggest, the wheel squeaks loudest. Yeah. So I don't have a chosen object, I just go with my attention wherever. Sometimes this is quite fun to do, you know, where does my attention go? You let people in a kind of a room with different toys, and you let them play and see where do they go. Some just kind of, they don't start to play, they wait till they get invited. And others kind of scan everything and kind of go, make careful choices. Others are kind of doubting around, say, ooh, this is nice, I take a little bit of this, then over there, a little bit there, and then a little bit there. Some kind of tentatively wait to what's left over and see kind of whether nobody's taking it away from them. Yeah. It's quite interesting to see where our attention goes and how we operate. But most of the time, when we want to get something done, or we want to learn something, or we want to have some success in something, we need to focus. Yeah? And that means focusing is not just focusing, it means also renouncing things. Every focusing is a renouncing. If you want to dig deep, if you want to dig a deep hole, you have to stop digging small holes. Yeah, you have to decide which place you're going to dig your hole, and then you dig it, and you don't stop. You think, oh, that's a nice corner over there. Yeah, your hole is never going to get any deep. We know that. It has differing names. It has kind of, we call it follow through or commitment, or Buddhists call it renunciation. Politically very, very incorrect, and it's kind of, it doesn't go down, it's a very bad PR term, renunciation. But basically that's what it is, you know. If you want to get something going, you need to renounce all other possibilities for that moment, at least. Every yes you say is only as much worth as you're prepared to protect it with no's, yeah. If you say, I marry you, and I marry you, and I marry you. Somehow this doesn't quite mean the same, eh? So, this is the second stage would be, you have chosen something as the focus of your attention, and you keep being pulled off it, yeah? You have made a choice, and this is your attentional focus. You're willing to make the necessary acts of renunciation, by saying, no, now not, I'm doing this, I'm thinking about this, I'm attending to this, but then you get pulled off, you know, by habit or by stuff that triggers your involuntary attention. You get pulled off, but you know this is my choice, yeah, and you come back. This is already meditation. Yeah, you've made a choice, you do this, it's difficult, you get pulled off, and you get pulled back. Next stage would be something like, you can hold your keel, yeah? You can hold your choice. You have chosen something. There's still a considerable pull, but basically you're noticing that that pull takes place, but you're no longer pulled off it. Yeah? There's still a lot of distraction, thought, noise, offers, appeals are happening in your mind, but basically you're able to sustain your attention on a topic, on a theme, on an activity, on a process, on an object. Your attention is still very much focused on that object. Your degree of stillness is still very much contingent on that object, on the suitability of that object, and on the object at all. Yeah. Next stage is there's a stillness and fluidity of mind that has a spacious quality, and within that space, objects arise and change and disappear without your awareness collapsing with the change of the object. Yeah, it means suddenly from an object-specific type of attention, you have an attention that has a spatial quality, and within that space, objects can arise and cease without your spacious attention going away. Yeah. Your quality of attention has now a stability that it does not depend on individual objects anymore. Yeah. That's when it starts getting interesting. Yeah. When your attention is no longer object-specific, or you can actually notice that your breath has tapered off and completely gone, and right now you're in the pause section of breathing, and your awareness is still there. Yeah. It is when you start listening into the breaks, into the pauses, into the gaps. I like London. Yeah, it's hard work getting through your transport system here, and getting through your city at all, in fact. But there are countless pointers of meditation, you know, that mind the gap. It's a fantastic meditative reminder. as is that, you know, really viscerally hostile tone, thinly veiled by polite language and tonality that says, you know, do not obstruct the door. You know, it says something about how people can say polite things in a really hostile way. And this is very crucial, not just what they say, but how they say it. That holds true for meditative activity as well. If we say the right things to ourselves, but in a hostile way, we keep breeding that hostility as part of our meditation practice. Yeah? It's very crucial to notice. I often speak with people what they do in meditation. They say, well, I do anapanasati, I be with the breath. Then you speak a little longer with them, and after 2 minutes of listening to how they describe what they do, it becomes obvious that they talk in the sharp voice of a authoritarian interject with themselves, and basically that they bark at themselves every time they go off their breath. Yeah? And no wonder does meditation feel bad to them. You know, it gives them, doesn't help them with their self-esteem. It's hard work. It seems to just kind of produce headaches and not make for happy moments of being. And then they obviously blame it on Anapanasati, the Buddha, or the teacher. Yeah? But you realize that how we attend, how we address, how we enter into relationship. But that's what sati really is about. If you want to have the common denominator of all the bits, the images, sati establishes relationship. That's as simple as it gets. Sati is the willingness and the continued activity of establishing a relationship with what takes place right now. The suchness of your moment right now, the substance of your mental states, of what you wish and what you fear and what you like and what you don't like, the suchness of your bodily states, the suchness of your contextual world, all this has to be related in some way, and sati is what establishes that relationship. In fact, sati is this relationship, and that relationship is not just defined by content, it is primarily defined by attitude. So some meditation teachers, like Ajahn Chah, for example, didn't do any meditation method. Yeah. Never taught the method. Just not. Mm-hmm. Just no method. All his teaching is attitudinal. No tricks. It's your attitude towards something. Now, I think methods are quite useful, but we are probably quite method manic here in the West. Yeah. We believe somehow deeply by doing the right thing, basically we get the right product, whether that is the right diet or the right teaching or the right car or the right trick or the right coaching points here, or the right meditation method. We believe that the effect and the fruit of our meditation practice is directly related to our method. And the truth is, methods are indispensable, but the fruit of your practice is much less related to the method you choose than to other circumstances in your life. Attitudinal stuff. Yeah. How you approach this. How angry you talk to yourself. How patient, how sloppy you are. How caring you are. How willing you are to be with things that are not easy. What's happening in your life has a tremendous impact on what's happening in your meditation. We can't really write that in our brochures, but the truth is, you know, when you come and meditate, the results you get of your meditation have a lot to do with what's happening in your life. So you can't fix that in your meditation practice. You can gain some shift of perspective on what's happening in your life, in your meditation practice, and you can learn some things, how to influence what's happening in your mind. You know? And that again will change slowly what's happening in your life. But that entails becoming aware of things, being willing to make choices, protecting these choices against habits or against peer group pressure, or just the sheer might of advertisement, and living out these choices. Yeah. So meditation can help change lives, but often meditation shows up what's actually happening in life. If we're running in our lives, and meditation is the invitation that things catch up with us, then these things will catch up in us. So our meditation will show the things we have been running away from. That's why meditation is more than just sitting. And that's why practice can never be just sitting. And that sati, with its many images and with its fundamental willingness to relate to the suchness of my life, of my moment, of my body, of my mind, of my situation, becomes a tool that goes way beyond the meditation mat and the meditation cushion. Please consider this when you think about practice, when you think about what is mindfulness, when you think about what is practice. Make it big. Without losing the precision, but make it big.